Are we ready? Are we doing this?
We are doing this.
Okay. I just need a minute because I got to think about my entire life before I start podcasting.
God damn it.
Jade from New Jersey. It's the SNL Nerds, the show where two comics from New Jersey nerd out over Saturday Night Live. I'm your co-host, John Trumbull.
I'm your co-host, Darren Patterson.
Hi, Darren!
Hey, John, how's it going? Welcome to the new norm.
It's fine. It's, you know, same old story. Same as it ever was.
Yeah, it's just, we're just living, it's Groundhog's Day for real. Just every day, we're just living it on a loop.
Every day starts out with Sonny and Cher singing I Got You, Babe. And, then we do our report in the town square, and then, you know, we do all that other stuff, and there's a blizzard, and we try to get Andy McDowell to fall in love with us, but she stops responding to our letters.
Phil Connors?
Ned!
Oh, watch out for that stuff. It is a doozy. Oh, God, that growl. Oh, that growl.
You gotta love that growl.
Gotta love it.
Enough, we are not here to talk about Groundhog's Day. We are here to talk about Dewey Cox, Walk Hard, the Dewey Cox story from 2007.
December 1st, 2007, written by Judd Apatow and Jake Kasdan, and directed by Jake Kasdan. Jake Kasdan, great director. He started off doing, he did the movie Zero Effect. He did episodes of Freaks and Geeks. Another underrated movie he directed, Orange County, which I really liked. Mm-hmm. And I think most recently he's done Bad Teacher and the Jumanji reboots.
Jay Kasdan, I think, is a very underrated guy. He's been in Hollywood forever. He's the son of Larry Kasdan, but he still seems to be flying under the radar somehow. He doesn't have a big breakout hit to his name. I guess maybe the Jumanji movies, but...
Yeah, I mean, those are, I guess, financially, they're big hits, but, like, I mean, as far as, like, you know, kind of staying power and being so memorable, I don't know if they quite hit that mark. I think he was hoping this movie would do it, but as we'll talk about, it did not do great when it came out.
It did not, and that's a real tragedy, because it is such a good movie, it is such a funny movie, and... people just slept on it. It just did not do what it should have at the box office.
The budget was $35 million, only made 20 worldwide.
Yeah, that's not good. That is a flop by any standard.
Yeah, it's not good. It's bad.
And I remember the studio was behind it. They were doing they were pushing this movie. There were photographs of the star John C. Reilly, made up to look like Jim Morrison. You know, those famous shirtless photos of Jim Morrison. We had John C. Reilly dressed up as Dewey Cox like that. And it's just a funny image. And it just didn't strike the public's fancy for whatever reason.
Yeah, it kind of, I thought about it. I was trying to figure out why it didn't hit like it did. I mean, maybe part of it was because the character Dewey Cox is a fictional made up character, and he was made in order to for this movie where it's like a parody of all the musical biopics, specifically Walk the Line, which came out 3 years before this movie, and Ray, which mm-hmm. came out about 3 years before this movie.
Yeah,
and I thought about it. The way this movie is kind of structured, it kind of reminded me of another movie we reviewed, the Austin Powers films, where this character, Austin Powers, was created to sort of make fun of a certain genre of movies, which is the James Bond movies. But
mm-hmm.
I don't know. I mean, because from what I remember, I don't think Austin Powers did well originally, but then after it came out on video, started to get its following. And I maybe because like Mike Myers is a bit of a bigger deal than John C. Reilly, I guess, like or at least in the comedic circles. Maybe that's why he was able to sort of do a little bit better. But yeah, this movie, Walk Hard, it never reached that, and I don't know why.
It's a shame. I actually, when researching for this episode of the podcast, I came across an oral history on the website The Ringer, And it's an oral history by Alan Siegel. It came out about a year ago. It's called Dewey Cox Ain't Dead, An Oral History of Walk Hard. And they talk with most everyone who had a major part in the movie. And a big theory here was that the movie, it came out during a writer's strike. So most of the big nighttime talk shows were dark at the time because they didn't have any writers. So, and they were saying this was really a movie where you kind of had to explain that it's like a biopic, but it's not a biopic of a real person. Like, there wasn't an actual Dewey Cox, even though the movie pretends that there was. So maybe people needed more of an on-ramp to it. And they said that's something that we could have explained on a talk show, and we could have done a better job of promoting it. And I was like, okay, well, that makes sense. And that's a shame, because that's just bad timing. And what can you do about it? And and John C. Reilly, he said in the oral history, he was actually depressed for a couple of years because the movie didn't do so well. And they believed in it. They believed in it so much, and they thought they'd done such a funny thing. And they really did. I mean, the movie was a flop through no fault of its own, I think.
Yeah, I would say so. Because I remember, like, when the movie came out back in 07, like, it seemed like a lot of people were kind of confused by it. Just like, who's Dewey Cox? Is this like a SNL sketch I'd never seen? What is his character? And I remember I saw this in the theater firsthand. And I remember, I'll say this way. There wasn't a shortage of empty seats for me to find when I first saw it. It was like pretty empty. Yeah, yeah. But when we decided to do this movie, I'm actually kind of glad we settled on this one. I mean, I know we kind of picked it because this film is like near and dear to your heart. This is like your MacGruber, as it were.
Yeah, that's fair.
And when I said, oh yeah, let's do this, I was kind of like, you know, half-hearted about it. Cause I mean, I haven't seen it in over a decade. And like the last time I'll get there.
All right. I'll give you enough rope to hang yourself.
No, cause like I haven't seen this film in years. And the last time I remember seeing it, I thought it was okay. I thought it was funny. And after rewatching it this morning, like, I forgot how seriously funny this movie was. Like, there was a bunch of parts where it's like, oh yeah, I forgot about that. Like, it was a surprise to me watching it. And like, I genuinely had like a big smile and like big gut laughs, like that I haven't had in a while. Like, this was a genuine joy for me to watch this movie.
Oh, that's awesome. I'm so glad to hear that. This was the first time in a while I'd revisit the movie. I probably hadn't watched it in a couple of years. And because I own it on DVD, and there's a two-disc unrated edition that I watched. And so that has both a theatrical cut and the unbearably long self-indulgent director's cut, which is, that's 2 hours. And the theatrical version is 96 minutes. So they put a lot of extra stuff into the extended cut. And there's a lot of funny stuff in there. So I think the last few times I watched it, I watched the extended cut. So it was interesting to revisit the theatrical cut. And there was at least one line in there that I had totally forgotten about, but it made me laugh out loud. It made me laugh so hard I had to pause. I had to pause on Netflix and rewind it a bit to listen to it again. But Actually, let me give the description of the movie. I haven't really done this for the uninitiated. I've got the description on the back of my DVD here. So you have one of the most iconic figures in rock history, Dewey Cox, John C. Reilly, had it all. The women, over 411 served, the friends, Elvis, the Beatles, and the rock and roll lifestyle, a close and personal relationship with every pill and powder known to man. But most of all, he had the music that transformed a dim-witted country boy into the greatest American rock star who ever lived. A wild and wicked send-up of every musical biopic ever made, Walk Hard, the Dewey Cox story, is a gut-busting proof that when it comes to hard-rocking, living, and laughing, a hard man is good to find.
Oh, nice.
So,
well said, sir.
So, yeah. So, if you're not familiar with this movie, it is available on Netflix streaming right now, which is a big reason why I thought it would be fun to do this, because it just popped up recently on Netflix, and it came up in my recommendations, and I was like, oh, yeah, Walk Hard. And it came up as a popular on Netflix right now, so I think a lot more people are checking it out now.
Yeah, hopefully, like after this podcast, even more people will check it out. Because I'm saying it right now. This movie did not deserve to get slept on. It did not.
If we can help spread the word of Walk Hard even a little bit, I will be happy. My life will not have been in vain.
Yes.
And hey, when you start to watch it on Netflix, when you get on the screen, it says it's you know, it's rated R for sexual content, graphic nudity, drug use, and language. So, I mean, come on. And it's funny.
Yeah. You got to like one of those things, people.
Exactly. I mean, one, if not three or four of those things.
Yeah.
So should we get into it? Do you want to dive into Walk Hard? You want to get some more cocks?
Oh, God. This review is going to have a lot of cocks and innuendos, I'm imagining.
Lots of cocks just all up in your face.
It's jamming that cocks in your face and in your ears.
We are going to stick cocks in every possible orifice in this podcast.
Oh boy. Oh God. Oi. So let's start. So the movie begins with a concert that's about to go on, and the stage manager, played by Nat Faxon, he's looking for Dewey Cox, who's supposed to go on stage, and he can't find him. He's supposed to go on in 2 minutes. It's like, is Dewey Cox here? Is Cox? I can't find Cox. I need to find Cox.
And I need Cox. I desperately need Cox.
Yes. And then he sees Dewey Cox in the hallway, kind of in the shadows, like kind of staring at a wall in contemplation. And it's almost very blue. Yes, very pensive.
Yes.
And then, of course, he says, oh, Mr. Cox, you're on in 2 minutes. And then Dewey Cox doesn't answer him. And then we have Tim Meadows comes up behind him. Mm-hmm. And he tells the stage manager, just give him a minute, son. Dewey Cox needs to think about his entire life up to this moment before he goes on stage.
Yeah, yeah. And then that gives us the structure for the movie. So we then immediately flash back to Dewey's childhood in Springbury, Alabama in 1946. And he's just got this idyllic life with his brother, Nate, who's like playing piano brilliantly. And it does that usual movie thing where it's like cutting between two hands that are masterfully playing the piano. And then it, instead of panning up, it just cuts to the actor. So you know the actor's not really playing. Which is always amusing.
Right. So, Dewey, they show Dewey as a child, and he has his brother, Nate, who is like, you know, the golden child of the family, who mom and dad love very much. And then I think Nate says, oh, hey, Dewey, let's go out and play. And then they say a line in here saying, hey, wow, today's going to be a great day, Dewey. Ain't nothing bad's going to happen to us today.
Ain't nothing horrible's gonna happen today. And then we cut to like a montage of them doing all these foolhardy danger stunts. They're playing with a bull, they're playing with a rattlesnake, they're going joyriding on a tractor.
Yeah.
They're doing all this stupid stuff.
Yeah.
And by the way, on the DVD, there's a behind the scenes thing of the shot of the kid running away from the bull. That of course is a composite. They just shot the kid running separately, and then they shot a bull separately, and then just green screened the bull in. But when they were shooting that, the bull actually got loose out of the pen he was in and wrecked the camera.
Oh shit! Oh
man! What they did, they like sealed off this area, and then they had the trailer that the bull was in backed up in there, and then they just covered all the gates with like blue tarps. And they had a matador who just waved a purple cloth in front to get the bull to run towards the camera.
Oh, purple? I thought it was red. Like the
They said it was purple, so.
Bugs Bunny cartoons lie to me? Is that what you're trying to say?
Yes. Yes. And Bugs Bunny didn't really enjoy cross-dressing nearly as much as the cartoons indicated that he did.
Wow.
That's also a myth.
Did you ever find Bugs Bunny attractive when he put on clothes and be a girl bunny?
What? yeah, thank you for the Wayne's World reference.
Swing!
But anyway, so the bull gets loose and it charges towards the camera, but then it jumps the fence and it knocks the camera over, destroys the camera, and they have to... And then we see the crew, they had footage of the crew like getting out of the way of the bull and diving into the truck so that they're not trampled by a bull. Thankfully, no one was hurt, and they did recover the bull and all that, but...
God damn.
Yeah, and that's just for one shot.
That's where the Oh, that budget just went up just a little bit.
Yeah. So that's part of that $35 million right there. And then we have the two kids, and in this montage, they start having a mock sword fight with machetes, and they're covered in the sheaths. But as young Dewey is playing with the machete, the sheath slips off the machete, and he accidentally cuts his brother Nate in half.
Right. Now, it may sound gory, but like the way it's shot and played off, it's more cartoonish. Like, like the Black Knight scene in Monty Python, The Holy Grail.
Right. Yeah. There, I don't think there's even any blood. It's just, and he is bisected just right at the waist. So then they just cut to the young actor, and he's like in the ground up to his waist. And then there's like a set of legs standing next to him, still upright.
Right.
And he's like, "Oh no, Dewey, I'm cut in half pretty bad. You're going to have to be double great for the both of us." Cause like Nate, of course, was the favorite son and he was the gifted musician. So everybody expected great things of him.
Right. So then, so after this, like they had to get young Nate to the doctor. The doctor said, like, couldn't do anything. Your son is dead. And of course, that's the worst
case of being cut in half that I've ever seen.
Exactly. And of course, then we get to the line that Dewey's dad says to Dewey that gets repeated throughout the movie. The wrong kid died.
The wrong kid died!
Exactly.
I gotta give a shout out to the actors playing Dewey Cox's parents. We got the great Margot Martindale, who today I think she's best known for Justified, right?
She's done a few things before. Other than that, but yeah, I think like Justified was like the one thing that kind of put her on the map. But she's one of those actors that's been in 100 things. She's been around for ages.
And I think probably the thing that she was best known for at the time of this movie was she had played Elvis Presley's mother a few times. She'd played him on, there was a short-lived TV series called Elvis, which I remember, which was just sort of like a biographical series about Elvis in his early years, and she played Elvis's mom on there, and I think that's the first place I ever saw her. And Dewey's father is played by Raymond J. Barry, who's this just very familiar looking character actor. Again, one of those people you've seen in a million things, but he is really funny in this movie too.
Yeah, he's good. They're both great. And so at this time, you know, now that Dewey is filled with all this guilt that he killed his brother, wrong kid died. And that's when he loses his sense of smell, too. He's not able to smell anything.
He goes smell blind, as you do when you accidentally cut your brother in half with a machete.
Yes, smell blind.
No. I mean, this is very much, from what I understand, it's very much parodying the early scenes in Ray, the Ray Charles biopic that Jamie Foxx won an Oscar for. Because Ray Charles had a brother who died at a young age, and then Ray Charles went blind after that. And you posted a video on the SNL Nerds page that showed some of the references in Walk Hard, and it showed some scenes from Ray that this movie was partially inspired by, I guess.
Right, absolutely. Those are straight from the movie, Ray? I haven't seen it in years. I saw it in the theaters when it came out. I thought it was... Mm-hmm. I thought it was good. It might have been a little too long, but I remember liking it.
Yeah, I never got around to seeing that one. I have seen Walk the Line with Joaquin Phoenix and Reese Witherspoon, and there's a lot of Walk the Line in this movie too.
Yeah, I mean it's pretty much straight up Walk the Line, but like funny.
Yeah. I mean I'd say the basic arc of the movie is very similar to Walk the Line, and especially like. Johnny Cash's tumultuous relationship with his wife.
June?
Yeah, June Carter Cash.
Right.
Dewey's despairing because he accidentally killed his brother. And then his mom sends him to the store to pick up some stuff, like literally minutes after his brother's died. And there are these two old African-American gentlemen who are playing the blues. And Dewey's like, "Hey, I'd like to give that a try," and they hand him the guitar and they tell him like the chords real quickly, and then he is instantly like strumming the guitar like he's been doing it for decades, and he's singing like a 70-year-old black man.
I cut my brother in half.
Yeah, Yeah, and it's just this, it's this gravelly old voice, and, yeah. and it's just really funny just hearing that voice come out of like an 8-year old.
Yeah, it's pretty funny. And then then the next scene they cut ahead to Dewey Cox as a teenager, where he's mm-hmm. supposed to be a 14-year old getting ready to play in a talent show, but 14-year old Dewey Cox is just full grown John C. Reilly in like a youngish haircut.
Yeah, and John C. Reilly, he was like, he had to be at least 40 when he was doing this movie. and it's made all the more hilarious because, like, the high school kids around him, the high school and middle school kids, they're played by actual kids. So it looks all the more absurd, just have a full-grown John C. Reilly saying, like, hey, mama, I'm 14. and this is also, like, a big biopic trope because you want to get your lead actor in the movie as early as possible. So sometimes they stretch things past the point of credibility by having them play younger than they can believably play. I think Kevin Spacey played Bobby Darin in a biopic, and I think he played him like really young. I think Kevin Spacey was actually, at the time he played Bobby Darin, he was like older than Bobby Darin ever lived to be.
Oof.
So, yeah. And he played him like absurdly young, like 18 or something like that.
Oh my god, yeah. I mean, the makeup department can only do so much.
Yeah, yeah. His mom's like, oh well, it's so incredible that you become such a musician, and even though you don't have a sense of smell, and he's like, oh, mama, I learned to play by ear. and so Dewey comes out to this high school talent show, and he plays a song he's written called Take My Hand, and he starts playing the song, and the kids all start dancing. They just start doing the twist very slowly, very, you know, in a repressed Midwestern kind of way. And then, like, the girls rip their blouses open, and then a riot starts. They start punching in people in the audience. And
yeah, because, like, all the adults are like, that's the devil music. What do you do? Like, he's singing this very sweet, kind of like, you know, doo-woppy, Take My Hand song, but to the audience, it sounds like, you know, fornicating music.
Yeah, yeah. And we cut to the Dewey household later that night, and the priest is like, well, you know who has hands? The devil! And he uses them for holding. And, you know, it's just the rock music is the soundtrack of Satan sort of thing.
Yeah, and also, and we should bring this up too, like, also during the show, he locks eyes with a young woman in the audience, and he points to her, and that woman is Kristen Wiig.
Yes, playing Edith, his 12-year-old girlfriend, which it's getting very Jerry Lee Lewis in the Great Balls of Fire movie, if you remember that.
Yes.
That movie was like late 80s and had Dennis Quaid playing Jerry Lee Lewis and a young Winona Ryder playing his 13-year-old cousin, who Jerry Lee Lewis in real life married his 13-year-old cousin. So,
like, Jesus Christ, I still can't get over that. Like, oh, wow,
yep.
Wow,
yep,
wow.
So, So Dewey gets thrown out of the house, and Edith loves Dewey so much she goes with him, and then we cut to like a few years later, and we see Dewey is now working as like a busboy in this nightclub, and Craig T. Robinson is playing the resident band leader there, Bobby Shad.
Right.
Craig T. Robinson, who you know from The Office and all sorts of other stuff.
Hot Tub Time Machine, a few Apatow movies. Yeah, so he plays the big singer in this predominantly black nightclub.
Yes, where predominantly black patrons come to dance erotically.
Exactly. And yeah, like I said, Dewey Cox is like, he's like the busboy. He mops the floors and he kind of, does the dishes. But like every night he's there looking at Bobby Shad, like, and how he performs and everything.
Yeah.
And
go ahead.
Well, no, yeah. And at this point, like, as he's doing this, he's also going back home to the apartment he lives in with his now wife, Edith, who they have a child, and Dewey is 15 years old at this point.
Yeah, 15-year-old with a wife and a baby. And And now Edith has between scenes just totally morphed into like the nagging wife. She's saying like, Dewey, you got to give up on this music thing, and you get, and my dad can get you a permanent job at the slaughterhouse, and that's a job of the future. And Dewey doesn't want to give up on his music, and he's like, I need you to believe in me. And she says, I do believe in you. I just know you're gonna fail.
Like, God. I mean, like, we're like what, 15 minutes into this movie, and like, I've. This movie already has some genuine hearty laughs it's gotten out of me. Yeah. Like, I was like, yeah, like, wow, this movie's really good. Like, why haven't I watched this more often?
And it's hitting all the tropes of the biopic, particularly the musical biopic. Because, I mean, like, if you're compressing anyone's life into a 2 hour or an hour and a half movie, you got to just hit the highlights. And so everything in our biopic happens really, really fast. I mean, even if somebody struggled for years, it seems like it's an instant success. And Dewey's like explaining to his life, his wife Edith, he's like, I'm going to have to work hard at this. It's a long, hard walk. I'm going to have to walk hard. And then we see Dewey get this faraway look in his eye where he's just been inspired to write his trademark song, Walk Hard.
Right, absolutely. It's good. So then they cut back to one night at the nightclub where Bobby Shad can't perform because he punched his landlord and he broke his hand while he has laryngitis. So he can't play the guitar and he can't sing.
Yeah, so both of his hands are bandaged up and he can barely speak. And he's like, well, what are we going to do? People come here to dance erotically and now we've got no one to perform for them. And Dewey says to the manager, he's like, excuse me, sir, I know the act. I can do it. It'll be just like he's doing it, except it'll be me. And having no other choice, the manager of the club says, okay, Dewey, you got a shot. And then just before he goes out to perform, we find out some suits from the record company have come to see that night's performance. And there are these three Orthodox Jews.
I totally forgot about this. And when I saw that scene, I was like, oh shit. And like, that got a big, like, that's almost like a, not almost, but it is, that's like a Mel Brooks joke. Like,
yeah. And Mel Brooks was very fond of putting the Orthodox Jews in his movies. And the three Orthodox Jews who are like, they run show business, as they say, they are named Lahayim, Mazel Tov, and Schmendrick. And they are played by Harold Ramis, the late great Harold Ramis, Phil Rosenthal, who's probably best known as the producer of Everybody Loves Raymond, and Martin Starr from Freaks and Geeks and Silicon Valley.
Right. Yeah, I thought something like that would just be like a quick, like a visual gag, but no, this goes on for a good chunk of the movie too. It's like a, mm-hmm. It's not just like a quick running gag. They stick with it, and I applaud them for that. Like, I applaud them for just going ahead and just naming these, you know, Hasidic Orthodox Jews, L'chaim and Shmendrit, like...
And Mazel Tov.
I don't know. I was like, if I was Jewish, would I be offended? Is this offensive?
Well, I think they're saved by the fact that they had... I mean, the movie was, like, produced by Jews. We got Judd Apatow, and I believe that... Jake Kasdan is Jewish as well, so
right.
They can kind of take refuge in that. So
right, so the suits from the record company sit down, and then of course Dewey's very nervous, but he goes up and he sings the song that he's seen Bobby Shad sing numerous times, and it's called "Love Your Negro Man," and yeah,
you gotta love your Negro man, and he even does the patter on stage. That Bobby Shad would do, and he's doing it in like Bobby Shad's voice, and he's like, this song's about when a woman catches you with some strange, and the black audience is just staring at him like, what the F are you doing, boy? And then he starts singing, and then everyone's like, oh, well, he actually sounds pretty good, and then they just shrug, and then they start dancing erotically.
Yeah, of course, as you do.
So then Dewey gets a shot in the recording studio, and he takes with him Bobby Shad's drummer, Sam, played by Tim Meadows, And we cut to him in a recording studio with Sam, his drummer, and then we meet the other two members of the band, played by Matt Besser and
Chris Parnell.
Chris Parnell, thank you. I was blanking on the name for a moment.
Yes, Chris Parnell, the best player, and Matt Besser from UCB fame.
Yes. Yes. And he's singing That's Amore. And the record producer, played by John Michael Higgins, is not impressed. And he's like, well, young man, I don't need to hear anymore. This was awful. And your performance was so bad. Your performance has shaken my faith in the Jewish people, because they came recommended by Shmendrick, Mazel Tov, and L'Chaim. And he gives Dewey and his band 15 more seconds to prove himself.
Right, like Dewey's like, let me try again. Let me restore your faith in Judaism.
Yeah, yeah. I would hate for you to lose your faith in Judaism because of me. So he says, let me play one of my songs. I think you'll like that a lot more. And Matt Besser, I think, turns to him and he's like, Dewey, we don't know this song. He's like, you just follow me. And then they start playing Walk Hard, and it is so incredible. It immediately turns around John Michael Higgins, and 35 minutes later, the song is a hit record.
Yeah, they cut to Jack McBrayer from 30 Rock, and he's a DJ playing Walk Hard. He's like, oh, we're playing this new song that's just hot on the charts. It just came out 35 minutes ago. Walk Hard.
Right. So Dewey's an overnight success. He and Edith get a house. They have a lot more babies. Dewey gets a chimp and a giraffe. And Dewey's going on the road, and Edith is nagging him that he's not there enough for the family. So there's more strife in the marriage.
Yeah, like at one point, like they have an argument, and she's holding a baby, and then there's like a crib with three babies in it. And I swear, like when they were having their argument, like she was holding the one baby, then the camera cut to Dewey, then it cut back to her, and she was carrying another baby.
Oh, I missed that. Oh, that's cool. That's a nice touch.
I'm not sure if like maybe I missed that or I dreamt it or whatever, but I'm pretty sure like she's holding one baby, then the camera cuts back to her, and she's holding two babies. I gotta go back and watch it.
Yeah, I'm gonna have to go back and watch it. So we see Dewey out on the road, and we see him. He's on this big tour, and he's there with some other rock stars in the early days of rock and roll, because we're now in the early 50s. And we see Frankie Muniz as Buddy Holly. Frankie Muniz from Malcolm in the Middle.
We all see the Big Bopper, played by John Ennis from Mr. Show fame.
Oh, yeah. And then just coming off stage is Elvis Presley, played by Jack White from the White Stripes.
Right.
And this is something the movie has a lot of fun with. They have, as most musical biopics do, you see the famous person the movie's about meeting other famous people, and they're always sort of hilariously miscast. I mean, like Frankie Muniz is Buddy Holly, who was like, I think at the time he shot this movie, he was still significantly younger than Buddy Holly.
Yeah. And they also do, it's another thing they do in this movie where they just, like, they know you have to, like, suspend disbelief, so they just keep, like, repeating like the truth that they're kind of living in. Like Dewey's like, oh, I don't know Buddy Holly, I'm nervous to go out there, and like you know, Frankie is like, don't worry man, you'll be fine, or my name isn't Buddy Holly.
Right. They call every famous person who cameos in this movie by their full name at all times, and he's like, well, gee, Elvis Presley, you didn't have to rattle him up so hard. And Elvis Presley, like, he's like, hey, there's just two things you have to know. I'm the king, and the other is, look out, man, I'll take off your neck. That's karate. Only two people know it, the Chinese and the king.
Yeah. I always wondered, like, how come Jack White didn't do more comedy? I thought he was really funny in this one quick scene.
He is. He's very funny. He makes the most of his cameo.
Yeah. Oh, and also, there's a quick cameo from Ed Helms, who plays the stage manager. This movie is, like, chock full of cameos.
Yeah, yeah. It's, you know, Jake Kasdan and Judd Apatow calling in lots of favors and getting a lot of their comedy buddies to come in and just do a shoot for a day or two. And, yeah, the movie's so much better for it. It's so much fun. And then we have... We go a little more into the fractures in Dewey's marriage. He sings a song that's a tribute to his wife. A life without you is no life at all. And we discover that Dewey's getting into drugs. He opens a door and his drummer Sam is in there, and he's smoking reefer.
Right.
And he just goes, get out of here, Dewey. You don't want no part of this shit. And And as he's trying to dissuade Dewey from smoking reefer, Dewey gradually becomes convinced that he wants to smoke the reefer.
Yeah, it's like, it's kind of like, oh, that's probably really addictive, that drug. He's like, it's not addicting at all.
Like, yeah. Like, well, it probably makes you impotent. He's like, no, it makes sex better. Well, it sounds really expensive. It's the cheapest drug there is.
Like, Tim Meadows, I swear, he's so underrated. Like,
Tim Meadows is so good in this movie. So incredibly good. I mean, most everybody's good in this movie, but Tim Meadows deserves a special shout-out.
Yeah, he steals every scene he's in, just, like, straight up.
Yeah, he really does. He really does. And it's a great runner through the movie. And so Dewey, he starts smoking the reefer. He starts stepping out on his wife, Edith. We have a scene where Dewey's calling home to Edith, and she's home with all however many babies they have at this point. And as the camera pulls back, we see like tons of naked people in Dewey's hotel room. So it's obviously like some sort of orgy has just happened.
Yeah. Like, she's on the phone, and like the drummer is like on the floor with two women. And he's like, Hey Dewey, can you be quiet on the phone? I'm trying to have sex with these two women.
Yeah, it's a little bit of a ladies' man coming out of Tim Meadows there. He's like, I'm trying to have sex with these two fine ladies here.
Yeah. One of the women has like drumsticks in her hand, so I don't know what they're going to do with that.
Oh, well, I didn't think of there was a sexual connotation to the drumsticks, but maybe so. Who knows?
Yeah.
You know, hey, if that's how you want to live your life, that's fine. And there's a flaccid penis right behind Dewey at some point. Yeah.
We see dong, and so while all this
for an unusually long period of time.
Yeah, it's a long one.
What, a naked guy just steps into the frame. We just see him from the waist down because it's a nice close up of Dewey, and so it's just John C. Reilly and a guy in his flaccid penis there, and he just stands there. You expect to see it for just a few seconds, but no, he's there for probably a full minute of screen time.
Like, hey, Dewey, have you seen my slippers?
Yeah. It's like, hey, Dewey, do you want some coffee? Not now, Bert. And just then, Dewey's dad visits, and he sees the aftermath of this orgy, and Dewey's dad, he comes with news that he and his wife, Dewey's mom, they were dancing to Dewey's song on the radio, and his mom lost her balance, and she fell out of a window and fell to the ground, and then a radio fell out of the window and crushed her head, and that all happened while they were listening to Dewey's song. So it's therefore his fault.
That's right.
And once again, the wrong kid died.
Wrong kid died.
So then Dewey opens another door, and Sam's in there. He's doing cocaine with some groupies, and he's like, "Well, tell me about this cocaine." And Sam says, "It turns all your bad feelings into good feelings. It's a nightmare."
Again, Tim Meadows sells the hell of it, and it's...
Yeah.
Oh, God.
He's like, I think I do want to try some of this cocaine. And then it cuts to Dewey singing, like, this thrash punk version of Walk Hard, which is really funny.
Yeah. Like it's a Sex Pistols did Walk Hard.
Exactly. And it's like, the mid-1950s. Right. And then just after that, I mean, we see Dewey, he's starting to lose control. He's yelling at the band and stuff because he's descending into the quagmire of drugs. And then a young lady walks in, Darlene Madison, played by Jenna Fischer from The Office.
And right. She says,
looking for a new backup singer.
Right. And and Jenna Fischer, she walks in looking quite nice.
Yeah, they, I mean, she's a beautiful woman to begin with, but they make her up to look absolutely smashing in this movie. She's got, you know, that 50s pinup girl kind of thing going on.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, very, very much in the style of Reese Witherspoon in Walk the Line.
Right.
And she's a very nice girl. She's been singing in her church choir since she was a girl. And we see the song that Dewey hires her for. It's a song called Let's Duet, which is just filled with these hilarious double entendres.
Yes.
Like the opening lyric is, in my dreams, you're blowing me some kisses.
I'm going to beat off all my demons.
Yes. And another one of my favorite lyrics in the song, here I am sneaking up behind you. And then Darlene turns away from him and she says, you can always come in my back door. So... And underneath this song, we've got scenes of the increasing sexual tension between Dewey and Darlene, where they're out for ice cream and they're both licking their cones suggestively.
Yeah, she's like deep throating a vanilla cone.
Yeah, and he's just doing some rapid tongue action on his cone. So think of that what you will.
Yes, Carvel.
Yeah, but you know, despite their growing urges, Dewey and Darlene decide to just be friends. And she says, while she's like on top of him in his bunk on the tour bus, let's never ever give in to our lesser desires. After all, we're not married. And then it cuts immediately to him and Darlene getting married.
Right. And I think at some point they mentioned that, like, from the moment they met to then, it's only been like 3 weeks.
Yes, yes, yes. That's all they could take. But so they get married, and they're in their hotel room, and they're about to consummate their relationship. Dewey's got Darlene's like legs up on his shoulders, and then his wife Edith comes in to surprise him.
Yeah,
and then Edith discovers that he has married another woman. Darlene discovers that Dewey was married with kids before, which he never mentioned in the 3 weeks they'd known each other.
It didn't come up. I don't know.
It's a little awkward.
He was eating ice cream. Come on.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
He had a mouthful of vanilla.
And Darlene's like, Dewey, how could you do this? And he's like, well, I don't know. I was really confused. And I mean, you're like, you told me about that dream where you were licking my balls, and that seemed like a signal. Which I had totally forgotten about that line. At that point, I had to pause the movie and just laugh for a couple minutes.
Okay, you're right.
I'm fine. I'm good. But like John C. Reilly, he throws that line away in just the most brilliant way possible. He's just like, you know, you told me about that dream where you were licking my balls, and that seemed like a signal. And it's just, oh, it is the funniest damn thing, man.
It's a good line.
So, yeah, so Edith and Darlene, they both leave him. They can't be married to a man who's married to someone else. And, like, Edith yells at him at one point. She's like, Dewey, it's illegal to be married to two people at the same time. And Dewey just goes, well, what about if you're famous? That's allowed, right?
He might have a point. Honestly, if Jerry Lee Lewis could do what he did, I don't know.
I mean, I think we're all in agreement that the rules should be different for famous people.
They're just better than us.
Yeah, they really are. They deserve more things in life.
And I also liked how there's one point where Dewey chases Edith back to their house, and like as he's going into the house, there's just a camel on their front lawn, and no, mm-hmm. no mention of it. Just a camel there.
So it's like, yep, oh, never come on. Yeah, and he still has the monkey. The chimp is still there. Dewey's like, okay, fine, you can take the kids, but I'm keeping the monkey. And while he's fighting with Edith, he has an inspiration for another song called "Guilty as Charged." And we see when Edith walks out on Dewey, loses it, and he loses his temper. He rips out the sink in the bathroom, and we see. He walks in on Sam. Sam's doing pills. He's doing uppers and downers. And so Dewey starts doing that as well. And under the song Guilty as Charged, we see just Dewey going into this hedonistic lifestyle. Just sleeping with lots of women, doing lots of drugs.
Yeah. And I think at one point he gets arrested for like buying coke off somebody. And he's locked up. And at this point, he is 21 years old.
Yes, yes. And like just before this on the tour bus, we see Matt Besser and Parnell talking on the tour bus, and they're like, does Dewey seem kind of depressed to you? And they cut to Dewey just singing, and they're like, well, yeah, before that was early Dewey. This is middle Dewey. You know, at one point he's, I think in one of the deleted scenes, he's having sex with a groupie, and while he's in the middle of having sex with her, he's just like, this is a dark period.
Yes.
So Dewey's busted for buying drugs. He's sent to jail. And then Harold Ramis as Mr. Lahiam comes in to visit him. And he says, we have to send you to rehab. or as he says in his Yiddish type of pronunciation, rehab.
And dude's like, oh, rehab. Oh, okay. I didn't see what you said.
Yeah, yeah. And we get like subtitled Yiddish in this, but it's subtitled twice, which is fun. Okay. Dewey's sent to like this hellish 1950s, early 60s rehab where they're constantly giving him more blankets or fewer blankets and he's hallucinating and.
Right. But at one point he says he's too hot. He's like, oh doctor, he needs less blankets. So they take off blankets. And then he says, now I'm freezing. It's so cold. Doctor, he needs more blanket. And at one point he says, I'm both hot and cold. It's like, all right, well doctor, he needs less blankets and then more blankets.
Yes. Yes. As Dewey has reached the depths, Darlene returns to him. She's like, I couldn't get you out of my head. And so he and Darlene are back together and they have a comical sex scene where they destroy half the room and beat the hell out of each other.
Yeah. As you do.
As you do. And then we cut to Berkeley, California, 1966, where Dewey and Darlene, they're happily married. I think they have a few kids of their own. And, you know, we're full into the hippie era where it's all flower power and we're having a party at Dewey's home. And they're like, hey, and Darlene's asking the band, hey, have you seen Dewey? I think I saw him. He was talking to that guy, Charlie Manson. Really nice guy. Yeah. His song's horrible, but he's so nice.
Oh, wow.
But because it's the 60s, Dewey's consciousness has been raised. He's thinking about the bigger world and people having injustices done to them, like women and midgets and such.
Yeah.
So he decides to write a song about the plight of the little man, about the plight of the midget.
Yeah, and it's done very much in the style of Bob Dylan. If you ever seen that Bob Dylan movie, Don't Look Back from 67, it takes on that tone quite a bit.
Yeah, yeah. Very, very funny song. So we have a nice little Bob Dylan parody in the middle there. Dewey, again, because of his race consciousness, he goes to India to meditate with the Maharishi. And he meets the Beatles. He meets the four Beatles.
This is one of the funniest scenes in the movie to me. I thought this was just...
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it works well out of context of the movie, too. And what I was talking about before with the deliberate miscasting of all the famous people that you see. I mean, we've got the Beatles. We've got Jack White.
Jack Black as Paul McCartney.
Yeah, Jack Black as Paul McCartney. Paul Rudd as John Lennon. And then who else? We got...
Justin Long was George Harrison.
Killer George Harrison impression.
He had a good accent. Everybody else's accent was kind of iffy, we'll say.
Yeah, and apparently they just cast Justin Long as a joke, and then they discovered after they cast him that he actually could imitate George Harrison to an eerie degree.
Yeah. And Jason Schwartzman as Ringo.
Yes, yes. And of course, like... The scene, you know, the scene works well on its own. It's worth checking out on YouTube. I've certainly watched it on YouTube a few times, and they're all like, "Well, remember when we, the four Beatles, we were in Hamburg," and they're all in these bad Liverpudlian accents. Paul Rudd, in particular, he's like, "There's no limit to what you can imagine," and then he like looks to the camera just to make sure you get it, and it's hilarious.
This is the four of them riffing together and, Dewey Cox and his bandmates are all there. And all those comedic geniuses just kind of bouncing off each other. It's something else.
Yeah. Yeah. And we have Matt Besser. He has one of my favorite lines in the movie. He just is like, he's talking to the Beatles. He's like, well, you guys are amazing. You guys are almost as good as the Monkees. You're great.
Shout out to Kevin Joseph Garifa.
Yeah. that's just terrific. So the Beatles, they suggest that Dewey take LSD with him.
Right.
And so he checks with his wife, and you know, he's like, look, honey, my problems were with like booze and reefer and PCP and pills and all this. It wasn't with LSD. You know, I'm sure it'll be fine. And she's like, okay, we'll go drop LSD with the Beatles.
Just this once.
And so then we cut to an animated sequence, and it's animated in the style of the movie Yellow Submarine.
Yeah.
Which is very cute, very, very funny. But Dewey has a bad trip because the LSD awakens his demons, and he starts dreaming about a machete cutting him in half and all that.
Right.
And at this point, nobody in Dewey's life knows that he accidentally killed his brother with a machete.
Yeah, like you'd think he would have brought that up to somebody, but I guess not.
It is his deep dark secret. So then the movie goes to 8 months later, and Dewey is now deep into his Brian Wilson period. He's grown a long hair, he's got a long beard. As the scene begins, he's been on a trampoline for 4 days. He's been recording the same song for 8 months, and he keeps layering more and more stuff on top of it.
Right, and then we meet his manager, Mr. Schwartzberg, played by David Krumholtz.
Yes. Not an Orthodox Jew, but still very, very Jewish in the context of this movie. Yeah.
So it's okay.
Yes. And Krumholtz, I saw in the oral history I looked at, he said that he'd been in Ray, and he played pretty much this part in the movie Ray. So,
oh, really?
So he's pretty much almost spoofing himself here.
Oh, I got to go back and watch that. I totally forgot about that.
Yeah. But Dewey is just, he's lost his way, and everybody gets fed up with him. His band leaves him, and they give out a litany of all the horrible things that he's done to them over the last 20 odd years.
Yeah. They're saying, oh, you slept with my wife. You slept with me. And I've had very confused feelings about it for like 10 years.
Yeah. And then Tim Meadows just goes, and you never once paid for drugs. and then they would cut back to Matt Besser and Chris Parnell, and they list new things. And then it just cuts back to Tim Meadows, and he's like, and you never once paid for drugs. And apparently that was just an improv on Tim Meadows' part. He had other lines, but he just decided to keep repeating that same line with more and more fervor. And it cracked everybody up. So,
well, it makes a strong point. You gotta pay for drugs at least once.
Fair is fair. Yeah. I mean, certainly on our drug binges, we alternate.
Thank you.
So,
yeah.
Yeah. Because it's just polite.
Thank you. In this economy? Come on.
Exactly. Yeah. So the band leaves them, and then they say, I guess this is the end to a chapter of your life, Dewey Cox. and Dewey Cox goes on another rampage and rips out a sink.
Right. And then his wife, Darlene, says, you need to quit the drugs. You're out of control. You know, you need to take a break from all this. Because, you know, Dewey Cox, at this point, he's like running himself ragged to make this perfect song to sort of encapsulate his entire life. And like you said before, he's kind of gone full Brian Wilson. He's in the studio trying to make a song with like a full orchestra. And like he has didgeridoos. And like,
I need didgeridoos! Yeah.
And like aboriginal percussionists, like, you know, people like grass skirts. And
yes.
So his wife is saying, you need to take a break. You need to stop doing drugs. And he says, all right, fine. I will take a break. I will stop doing drugs. And then they go and they hug, and as they're coming back from their hug, it's obvious he put something in his mouth. And the wife says, wait, what'd you just put in your mouth? Nothing. You know, I took some PCP just now, but, you know.
Yeah. And he's like, what did we literally just say? and we have Dewey running through the town high on PCP, and he's in his underwear. But it's not really underwear. It looks like tighty whities at first, but it's in the back. It's cut like a sumo wrestler's thing,
yeah.
You know. So a lot of John C. Reilly butt cheeks in this movie.
You see cheeks, John C. Reilly, or
yeah, you see a lot of Reilly.
Yeah, like John C. Heine. What?
So he's running through the town, and he is overturning cars because PCP gives you superhuman strength.
Yeah.
And
he climbed a building at some point.
Yeah. Yeah. And so he is thrown into prison again, and then he goes into rehab again, and he's having electroshock therapy. And then he once again sees the ghost of his brother Nate, who has now grown up in the afterlife and is played by Jonah Hill.
God. Again, I did not see I totally forgot about this part. And so it's basically his grown up brother Nate telling him to get his shit together. What are you doing? You're supposed to be, you know, doubly good for both of us, and you're here just, you know, pissing your life away. Get it together.
Yep. Yep. And just so Dewey finally he decides to get clean, and he turns his life around. And then we skip ahead a few years, we cut back to him in Malibu in California in 1976, and he's gotten his shit together. He's on a health kick. We see him jogging.
Jogging.
Yeah, he's jogging. And he's turned his back on songwriting. He can't write songs anymore. He's basically blocked. But he wants to revisit the old stuff, and his manager, Mr. Schwartzberg, gives him an offer from CBS, saying that they've offered him a variety show, the Dewey Cox Show, and this is kind of similar to something that the real life Johnny Cash did. He had a variety show in the 70s.
Yeah, I looked it up because
I think in the 60s.
I believe so, yeah, because, I looked it up to see, because, I remember, variety shows being a big thing in the 70s, and, because when they were doing it, they're showing him getting his variety show. It's like, oh, this kind of reminds me of something, I'm not sure what, and then I looked and saw all the variety shows they had in the 70s, and it was like, yeah, like you said, Johnny Cash had one, Tom Jones, Sonny and Cher, Captain and Tennille, Tony Orlando and Dawn, the Brady Bunch.
Yeah, Brady Bunch Variety Hour, sure.
Glenn Campbell, I believe, had one. I was like, damn, they're really giving these away like hotcakes, these things.
Yeah, that was like the trendy thing in the 70s. And I think they were also relatively easy to produce, like easy and inexpensive, I'm sure. So, yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And go ahead.
I was going to say, yeah. So then we cut to the Dewey Cox Show, his variety show, and he does like a disco version of Walk Hard.
Yes, as well as David Bowie's Starman, which has to be heard to be believed.
Oof.
And so although the show, it's doing okay, it's keeping Dewey out of trouble. It's not too artistically successful, and it's not too commercially successful. They're apparently getting their asses kicked every week by the Incredible Hulk, which is weird because I said a few minutes ago, this show apparently is on CBS, and The Incredible Hulk was also on CBS, so they're being beaten in their time slot by another show on the same network, which I don't think is possible, but okay.
The 70s were a wild time, man. Who knows?
They were. There were a lot of weird things. and we have him being interviewed by the great Jane Lynch. And Dewey's just trying to reassure everybody that he's family friendly. You know, our show's on every Thursday at 8 after the local news, and I'm not mainlining PCP anymore.
Oh yeah, because at one point Dewey had a talk with his manager saying, you know, people want to know you're not mainlining acid, so you have to go out and say that you're not mainlining acid anymore. And then it's like, all right, well, all I gotta do is go out there and say I'm not mainlining acid, and the manager like, you're not mainlining acid anymore. And right. He says, oh, I'm not going to promise that. So Dewey has a fluff piece interview with Jane Lynch. And then, you know, she kind of leans in. It's like, oh, this, I know you got to do this show. It looks kind of crappy, terrible. But, I got to do this terrible show, so I'm with you. And, she kind of needles him a little bit and, kind of bums him out. So then she asks, a bunch of questions that, you know, if she had done some prep, she would have known not to ask. Like, you're saying, oh, hey, how are you and your lovely wife, Darlene, doing? And he's
Darlene left me several years ago, but to answer your question, I do miss her terribly. And at one point, Jane Lynch just stops and she turns to her crew and she says, we can cut around this if this gets too sad, right?
And then the next question is like, oh, so what about all those kids you have? How are you doing with your kids?
And he's like, I'm currently in a custody battle for my children. Custody is being forced on me. I don't think that's right. I think if I don't want anything to do with them, I shouldn't have to.
That's such a hilarious thing.
And he just says it so matter-of-factly. It's great.
Yeah. And then she says, well, how about your parents? Your parents must be proud of you.
And he's like, well, my mother's dead and my father and I don't talk anymore. So not really. And then she's like, well, you're so busy. Do you ever take the time to stop and smell the roses? And he's like, I've got no fucking sense of smell. And he storms off.
Yeah, it gets rough. And of course, I think does he rip out another bathroom sink at this point in anger?
I think if at any point in the movie, if you have to question whether or not he rips out a bathroom sink, yes, he is ripping out a bathroom sink.
Right. So, at this point, he's very, bummed out and despondent. And he's at home and he gets another vision from grown up, the ghost of grown up Nate, Jonah Hill. Mm-hmm. And Jonah is saying, well, what are you doing? You're supposed to be making the great song that's supposed to encapsulate your life. And you're here doing this terrible variety show.
And all I want to do is write one masterpiece that's the culmination of your entire life. How hard is that?
And so then Nate talks. They convinces him to go see their dad because he's the one person that always made him felt like shit, and he never reconciled with him. It was just like the one thing he's avoided his entire life. So he goes to visit his father in the barn.
Yes. He unresolved issues there. So he goes to see his dad and. Tells dad that despite everything, he's always loved him and all that. And it culminates in Dewey and his father having a fight with machetes.
Yes.
As you do.
And, because he's like, I've been waiting my entire life for this. And Dewey's like, you have this?
Yeah. And dad, quite good at machete fighting. He comes very close to cutting Dewey in half, but he misses Dewey, and then he accidentally cuts himself in half. And then we see his dad, just exactly how young Nate was, half in the ground, half with upright legs next to him. He's like, son, now I finally realize for the first time in my life how easy it is to accidentally cut yourself in half with a machete.
This movie's ridiculous.
And he apologizes for blaming Dewey, and he says he's proud of him, and he's like, Dewey, you go be a better father than I was. And Dewey's like, oh, okay, well, that's not real tough to do. and then he dies just as he's about to say, I love you. He gets halfway out, and then it's like, you love what, Dad? You love what?
Yeah, and then Dewey flips out. He, knocks over his dad, still standing legs.
Yes.
And then he goes to his house and just rips out the bathroom sink, his go-to move. And he saws his couch in half at one point and punches out plants.
Yeah. Into the night, he is sawing his couch in half.
Yeah. He's bending spoons in the kitchen and jackhammering the sidewalk.
Flowers in his garden because he can't smell them. And finally, when he's about spent, when all his house is wrecked, one of his kids comes by and he just says, Dad, I was wondering if you wanted to have a catch. And Dewey's like, I think I would like a catch, son. Remind me again, what's your name again?
Yeah, this part I was like, wait, his son just came there by himself? How does he know where his dad lives?
I think by this point, maybe Dewey has custody of some of his kids. And it's living there or something. I mean, they kind of gloss over it, but I think it's something like that because it's probably a few years since the variety show thing and all that.
Yeah. I mean, I shouldn't be looking for logic in this, but still.
No, you should not be.
that's my fault. I apologize. I didn't mean to do that.
But he starts playing catch with his son and he's discovering the simple pleasures in life. And he says, this is what I've been missing out on all those years in the road. I need to do this with all my kids. And he's like, how many of you are there again? And he discovers that he's like, well, with my brothers and sisters, there's like 22 of us. And then there are another like 14 half siblings.
Yeah.
So he's 37 kids altogether.
Jesus. Yeah. Then it's him playing catch with.
It's gonna take a while.
Yeah. And it's just him playing catch with a number of children of all different sexes and ethnicities.
Yeah, at one point you see him playing catch with a young Asian man in his 20s, and he's like, are you sure you're one of my kids? Because Joey has no idea who all these kids are, because he was so uninvolved in their lives. But this is a montage that covers several years, and it's underneath the Partridge Family theme, come on, let's get happy.
Right. And so, he just spends time with all his many, many kids, and he doesn't make music for it all a while.
Right. Because why would you when your life is a montage running under the theme to the Partridge Family?
Yeah, you got a bus and everything, man.
Right. And then Darlene comes back into his life. Darlene is now age 50. She's split up with Glenn Campbell, who she apparently married at some point off screen. Because I guess that's a thing that happened.
Sure, why not?
And, Dewey goes on a walk with Darlene. He confesses that he's still always loved her. She's always loved him. He's like, you don't want this dirty old cop. Nothing I want more.
Tee-hee-hee.
So they're back together, and he says, hey, did you shampoo your hair today? And she's like, yes, I did. And he's like, yeah, it smells wonderful. And then we discover Dewey has regained his sense of smell.
He can smell again.
It's a miracle. It's a miracle. So Dewey goes off. He's smelling everything. He's smelling flowers. He's smelling horse shit. He's having a ball, just smelling everything. Cox is having a ball.
I see what you did there.
And then we get to even a few more years later, and Dewey's quite old. It's the present day, and he's talking to one of his kids who he's now quite close to, and he's like, and that's when I learned that quaaludes and water skiing don't mix.
It's a good lesson to learn.
It is. But Dewey is very happy with how his life has turned out. He has no regrets. He's like, it's been a beautiful ride. And then just then, because we haven't had any Jewish stereotypes in the movie for a while, we have Mr. Lahayim's son come by, and his name is Dreidel Lahayim, and he's played by, what's his name from The Big Bang Theory?
Simon Helberg.
Thank you, Simon Helberg. And he comes to bring Dewey's attention to the fact that his song Walk Hard, it's been included in a remix from a rapper named Little Nutsack. So we got Cox and Little Nutsack. What a combo.
Get it?
And it samples Walk Hard in the most superficial way. It's just like, you get me so hard.
It's pretty fantastic.
Yeah, it is. And he also, Dewey also learns that he's getting a Lifetime Achievement Award, and he's like, And Dewey, he doesn't want to accept it. He's 71 years old, and he's left that life behind. He's like, I gave that life up for a reason. I'm afraid of all the temptations. And Darlene convinces him that he can do it, though, and that he should accept. And so he does. He says, but if I'm going to do this, I got to get my band back together.
Right. So then he goes to find all his bandmates. He finds Matt Besser, his guitarist, living in a rundown trailer, and mm-hmm. Matt punches him in the face, and then he says, "All right, let's go do it." He meets a bass player, Chris Parnell. Chris, of course, hugs him, emphatically, yeah. And he agrees to do it. Yeah. And then the drummer, Tim
Meadows.
Yeah, and like the first thing that Dewey does is hold up a huge bag of weed, and the drummer is like, "All right, let's do it."
Yeah, and they're all together, and they're all in this hilarious old age makeup. Everyone has gone bald and has just like this huge tufts of hair on the side. Everyone in the band has gone bald,
Like Larry from the Three Stooges.
Yes. It's a very Larry Fine kind of look, or Peter Boyle, or you know, whatever.
Oh, like that. Nice. Putting on the Ritz.
Yeah, and then we get to the Lifetime Achievement Award. It's like a Rock and Roll Hall of Fame type of thing, and we have Jewel, Lyle Lovett, and Jackson Browne. They're all singing Walk Hard. And then Ghostface Killah comes in for some reason.
Ghostface Killah. Yeah, I remember seeing that in the theater. And I was like, what?
Yeah, because when I think of Jewel, Lyle Lovett, and Jackson Browne, your mind immediately then goes to Ghostface Killah.
It's ridiculous enough that like something like the Grammys would actually do that.
Yeah, yeah, and I've watched some of the behind-the-scenes featurettes on the DVD this morning, and Judd Apatow was saying, like, I've never felt more white than, like, when I was telling Ghostface Killer. He's like, hey, could you get a few more references to prison in there? Ghostface Killer, like, put in a line about a shiv.
That's brave. That is bold.
Yeah. And then we have one last scene where Dewey, he opens the door to come in on Sam doing some drugs, and he's like, Sam, what are you doing? And he's like, oh, it's a pill. It's a medication for erectile dysfunction. It gives you a boner.
Yeah.
But we've learned that Dewey has finally learned his lesson. He's like, you know what, Sam? I don't want any part of that shit. And he walks away, and Sam's like, no, you don't understand. It gives you a boner.
If a boner lasts for more than 4 hours, call more ladies.
Yeah, very ladies man type of line there.
Yeah. And there was this one point where Dewey's like, no, I don't want anything to do with that anymore. I don't want to give in to the Temptations. And then as he leaves, the old R&B group, the Temptations, is out there singing, you know, My Girl.
Yeah.
Then we see Dewey's like, ah, the Temptations.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a very, like, Naked Gun type of gag.
It is. It is a nice, goofy gag. And we got Eddie Vedder giving his induction speech for Dewey, which in the oral history, apparently, like, they originally wrote just a few lines for Eddie Vedder, but at the last minute they added a lot more to the speech. So suddenly, like, Eddie Vedder had, like, this 3-page speech to deliver, and they put it on a teleprompter for him, and when Eddie Vedder was done with it, he was just like, they're never going to ask me to do one of these things now.
Well, there goes that.
But Eddie Vedder plays it beautifully because he just plays it totally seriously. He's speaking about Dewey Cox with all this reference, like he's this actual rock legend. And he says, and now for the first time on stage in 25 years, here's Dewey Cox. And Dewey Cox plays his new song, Beautiful Ride, that sums up his entire life.
Yeah. I mean, also, this is something I noticed. Am I nuts, or does, like, an old Dewey Cox, did he kind of look like Tim Robbins? Am I nuts there?
I can see that. And I also think you are nuts. These two things are not mutually exclusive. Okay. Yeah, I can see a Tim Robbins in there.
Okay.
Sure.
All right. And, yeah, so... So then we have Dewey Cox playing this song, Beautiful Ride, for the rest of the movie. It's actually a really nice song. They kind of cut to, like, scenes in his life. Like, it looked like it was, like, all about, like, a lot of bonus footage that they cut out.
Yeah, but it very quickly becomes all these scenes that never occurred in his life. I mean, things like him jamming on a guitar with his dad severed in half, with his dad on the ukulele, and
yeah, and
just all these absurd things, but it's hitting on all the high points of his life.
Yeah, and then at one point, like, Dewey Cox is in, like, a shootout with some people, and then Chris Parnell, the bass player, is right next to him, and then he uses Chris Parnell as a shield as somebody's shooting at him, and then, like, Chris Parnell gets all shut up.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I don't remember that.
I don't think any of these were, like, genuine deleted scenes. I think they were all just absurd things that they shot just for this montage. But I could be wrong. But he finishes the song, and it's, you know, and it's a song that sums up your entire life and, you know, what your life should be and how you should take time to smell the roses and all that. And then It ends with a freeze frame, and then it just flashes on screen. Dewey Cox died 3 minutes after this performance.
Yeah, that was it's very abrupt. I was like, whoa.
and then they cut to another picture of Dewey Cox just like looking a little queasy.
Yeah. I didn't see that. That really surprised me. I was like, wow, that just came out of nowhere. All right.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, because, again, it's a very biopic thing. You always want to end on a triumphant note that, like, sums up their entire life. And then usually there's, like, a slug attack. So, like, you know, Dewey Cox died in his sleep. Blah, 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 blah. And then they're just like, no, Dewey Cox died 3 minutes after this performance.
And there was, like, another gag in this, too, where, like, as he's performing the song, he sees, like, the ghost of his mom and dad and little brother.
Yeah.
You know, like, yeah. Very Star Wars, Return of the Jedi, standing there.
Yeah, yeah.
And at one point, then they cut to the audience, to all the people in his life. Like, they cut to his Edith, his ex-wife, who's, like, with a new lover, I guess. And then they cut to...
I don't know if it was a lover or one of the kids, or... Yeah, I have no idea.
Oh, right, because maybe it was one of the kids. But then they...
It was a much younger man, right. Much younger Asian.
And then they cut to his manager, Schwartzbaum, and, like, he's enjoying the show, but then he has a heart attack, and he dies right there. And as he dies, yeah. He becomes one of the ghosts who walks next to Dewey's mom and dad. And
yeah, there are four ghosts. He just, like, literally a second later, he is there as a ghost.
Yeah.
So, yeah, very, very funny movie. That's, yeah, it's great. And I should also say the extended cut, also very funny. There's a lot of extra stuff in there. There are even some scenes from it made it into the trailers for the movie. There's a scene in the trailer where Patrick Duffy, the star from Dallas, he's like, what happened to you, Dewey? And Dewey just goes, I know what did happen. Patrick Duffy took a beating. And that's from one of the deleted scenes in the extended cut.
Oh, and yeah. I kind of remember.
We find in the 1970s that Dewey had a third marriage. He married the supermodel Cheryl Teagues, who... I guess she's best known. She was like one of the Sports Illustrated cover models. And she was like the big thing around late 70s, early 80s. And so she was, she became known as Cheryl Cox Teagues. So.
Wow.
It's kind of a shame they lost that gag in the theatrical cut, but I guess it slowed down the movie too much late in the game. But
bravo. But, I enjoy a good pun, and that is a good pun. Bravo.
I mean, that is a pun that could not have worked with literally any other actress. So kudos to them for casting Cheryl Teagues mainly just to do that pun.
Cock Teague. God damn. Wow.
That is spectacular, right? I mean,
I tip my hat to you, sir.
Judd Apatow and Jake Kasdan, tip of the hat to you, sirs. The SNL nerds, we doff our chapeaus to you.
Yeah, and that's Walk Hard. It's this was a genuine joy for me to see. Like, again, like, I first time I saw it, I thought it was okay. I remember, but then I don't know why, but like I watched it now and it's like, oh wow, I remember this is really funny. Like this should have done way better in the theater, and it should have gotten way more recognition. Like this is a hoot.
It is just a gem of a movie. It is really funny. It's really clever. It looks great. They do an incredible job just getting the look of all the decades throughout the movie. Like, so technically it looks great. I mean, it's just a very funny movie. And the theatrical cut, it's pretty short. It's just like an hour and a half, so it doesn't overstay its welcome. It covers a lot of ground in that time. I just love it. It's one of my favorite movies from the last 20 years or so. I can't believe it's 13 years old already.
Good Lord.
It's nuts, man. Time just moves too damn fast.
Oof. Time is something else.
But unfortunately, it did nothing at the box office. It just did not work well. But it enough people have rediscovered it. I think it can safely be called a cult movie. And it seems like a lot of classic comedies are like that. When they come out, people just aren't ready for them. But the right people discover them, and a cult develops around it. I mean, Spinal Tap was like that. And Walk Hard, I think, is like that, too.
Yeah, I would say, like Big Lebowski. I remember when that came out, no one really watched it. But now it's like this beloved cult movie.
Yeah, yeah. And in the oral history I read, John C. Reilly, he was talking to Mike Andrews, who was one of the music supervisors in the movie. And he said, like, well, you know, you can have a hit movie or you can have a cult comedy, but you can't really have both. And that's very insightful.
Yeah.
And he says, and John C. Reilly said, and if you have to pick one or the other, you know, having a box office smash that you're not exactly proud of is not as good as having a cult movie that nobody saw at first. So, you know, and it seems like everybody who was involved with it is still really, really proud of it. And they got some great friendships out of it. John C. Reilly and Tim Meadows got pretty tight. Jenna Fisher said that she knew when she auditioned for the movie, she knew John C. Reilly a bit already because they'd done another movie together. So when she was reading for the movie, she actually had enough of a comfort level with him that she like went up and sat on his lap, which she said, you know, I normally wouldn't do that in an audition with an actor I didn't know. But
oh my,
I really thought them cast her as Darlene. So,
oh, Dewey Cox.
Yeah. And Jenna Fisher said she was expecting to be cast as Edith at first. They had to convince her that she was who they wanted for Darlene. She was like, really? I never get this sort of part.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true. Because, I remember hearing in another interview, like, Jenna Fisher said, like, oh, yeah, I'm always, like, you know, the girl next door, the pretty but, you know, obtainable kind mm-hmm. of, you know, girl or woman,
yeah,
rather.
Yeah.
Like, she's never, like, you know, the buxom, you know, just eye candy. But like here she was, and she was like,
"Yeah,
she played it off well."
Yeah, I mean, she's really funny in this movie. I mean, everybody's really funny. There's not a weak link in the bunch, and we haven't really talked about the music much. But the music in the movie is really good too.
The "Love Your Negro Man" is a bop. It is a genuine awesome song.
The soundtrack of this movie, it slaps, as the kids say. And I mean, and it touches on all these different genres of music too. I mean, we've got like, you know, rockabilly type stuff. There's like there's a Roy Orbison type song. There's a Bob Dylan type song. There's a psychedelic late period Beach Boys type song. There's like a disco version of David Bowie's Starman. I mean, they did an incredible job, and they spent like months working on the music, writing all original tunes for it. John C. Reilly was very involved with it. He does all of his own singing in the movie because John C. Reilly's also like an accomplished singer. He was in the movie Chicago.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. And they said like when they were casting this movie, John C. Reilly was really the only person they considered because they wanted somebody who might genuinely star in a biopic. And they were like, because we basically saved John C. Reilly from having to do a biopic for real.
I can see that.
But they wanted somebody who could really perform the music on this. And they actually, one of the promotional things they did for this movie, because they couldn't really do the talk shows because of the writer's strike, in December of 2007, when the movie was getting ready to open, they did a little mini tour of John C. Reilly did 7 musical appearances as Dewey Cox. He performed at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Cleveland, Ohio. He was at the Chubby Bear in Chicago. Stubbs Barbecue in Austin, Texas, Mercy Lounge in Nashville, Tennessee, the Great American Music Hall in San Francisco, the Black Sheep in Colorado Springs, which is very appropriate because he has a song called Black Sheep, the Guitar Center on Sunset Boulevard in Los Angeles, the Knitting Factory in New York City, and he also performed in character as Dewey Cox on Good Morning America.
How did I miss that? Wow, I had no idea about all that stuff.
If I could go back in time, I wish I could have gone to that show at the Knitting Factory and seen him live as Dewey Cox. That would have been something else.
I want to see the Cox.
I mean, John C. Reilly, he should bring out the Cox again. Just someday, fling out the Cox. Let the Cox hang out there and
strip it out.
Yeah, yeah. Because, I mean, people want to see what the Cox can do, especially after all these years, you know?
Yeah, I'm sure the Cox hasn't aged a day.
I'm sure the Cox is just as solid as it was back in its heyday. And I bet the Cox can go for just as long as it did back in 2007.
Oh, wow. If it goes for more than 4 hours, call more ladies.
Yeah. Yeah, so... But, man, I just love this movie. It's such a fun movie, man. It's such a funny movie.
It's really good. Guys, if you take away anything from this, go watch if Walk Hard: The Dewey Cox Story. It's a really good movie for if you're like not only if you're a comedy nerd, just because they have so many comedic people from like different, you know, from like SNL and UCB and like Christopher Guest movies. Like, so they get all those bases covered. All the Apatow people are in this thing. And also, if you're a music nerd, if you're somebody who's really into music from the 60s, 70s, and 50s, like, this will really tickle your fancy as well.
Yeah, yeah. And it's it is a great soundtrack. I've owned the soundtrack for years, and I still listen to it to this day. There's a lot of great stuff on the soundtrack. They're not like, they're funny songs, but they're also just good songs. They're good sounding songs. So you can just listen to the soundtrack non-ironically, and it works beautifully.
Yeah, much like the Mighty Wind soundtrack, where it's like the songs are kind of funny, but they're actually extremely good as well.
Yep. So highest possible recommendation on Walk Hard. And it's on Netflix streaming, people. You have no excuse.
Yeah, you ain't got nowhere to go.
Yeah, where are you going to go? Are you going to go out to a restaurant? No.
Oh, you're busy? You're too damn busy?
You order in and you watch Walk Hard on Netflix, goddammit.
Right. Ugh, yeah. So we put out the word on Twitter that we were doing this, and we got one tweet from Puppet Perspectives saying, the best thing about the movie is all the blatant foreshadowing. Nate saying, ain't nothing going to happen to me today at the beginning to Tim Meadows' ironic anti-drug speeches. Great film. You guys should review The Other Guys next.
The Other Guys, was that the Will Ferrell, Mark Wahlberg movie?
Yes, it is.
Okay, yeah, I like that movie. I'm up for doing that if there's a way for us to watch that without too much trouble.
Yeah, I believe that's on Netflix as well. And that's another movie, like, I think when it came out, didn't do great. But, like, ever since then, it's kind of gained, like, a cult following. I've heard a lot of people saying The Other Guys is, like, a solid movie.
Yeah. That is solid. I haven't seen it since it came out, but I'll look forward to revisiting that. I'm up for that.
I've never seen it.
Oh, okay. Well, it's worth seeing. We don't have any new reviews on the podcast, on the Apple podcast. So if you want to do that, please do that. We encourage that. We love getting some feedback on it, even when the people don't care for one of the hosts.
Don't get me started.
Yeah, no. I mean, who knows? But I did get a nice note on Facebook from our friend Joanna, who's one of our more active, devoted fans.
Hey, Joe.
And she said, hey, John, hope you're doing well during the apocalypse. I just listened to the latest SNL Nerds. Really enjoyed it. You and Darren are my new buddies when I cook or bake.
Hey!
And that was about the, that was last week, so that was during the Austin Powers episode. So
yeah, baby. Yeah.
So we enjoy accompanying your cooking and or baking. So. Yeah.
Whatever you're doing in the kitchen, put us on. We help... We'll help make your flambé more flambéer.
Yeah, and let us know. Let us know on Twitter or wherever. What do you do while you listen to the podcast? Are you working? Are you doing household chores? Let us know. We're at SNL Nerds Show as the show page. You can also follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Trumbull Comic, TRUMBULL, and the word comic.
And you can follow me at Darren Credible. That's DARIN Credible on Twitter and Instagram. And we also got the Patreon. We could also use some money.
Yeah. We had a bonus episode that just came up just a couple days ago. Where we talked to Dave Siris, who is the co-writer of the new Judd Apatow movie, The King of Staten Island, with starring SNL's Pete Davidson. And we put that up on Patreon early for our Patreon listeners, or our Patreon benefactors. So, please contribute to the Patreon.
Yeah, just check us out on Patreon or on our website, non-productive.com.
Yes. And we're gonna start working up some more bonus content for the Patreon, and maybe even some exclusive contacts, really. Yeah, we'll send you a list of our contacts.
That's right. We'll put our contact list from our iPhones up.
Yeah, there you go. So some interesting people in they're in our contact list. I know a lot of comic book people, so yeah.
You can call my mom, sure.
Exactly. But I think that is it.
Do we want to mention what we're going to do next week? Do you want to?
Let's mention what we're doing next week. Let's go into it.
Your voice got really high.
I'm going through puberty.
Oh, man.
My body's undergoing many changes, Darren Patterson.
I'm 14-year-old John Trumbull.
That's right.
You got to love your Negro, man. the next film we're doing, we're going to go ahead and do it. We talked about it on the bonus ep. The King of Staten Island, Pete Davidson film, Judd Apatow film, just came out. We're
currently available on video on demand.
Yeah.
So we're going to shell out the money. We are going to watch this movie. It's been getting some good reviews. I'm looking forward to seeing it.
Yeah, absolutely. So, guys, stay tuned for that.
Yes. So that'll be next week, The King of Staten Island. So if you want to keep up with what we're saying, you can also go on to on demand and order that for your own self.
Mm-hmm. Spend your own money.
That's right. Because we're not going to buy it for you.
Oh, no. We can't hold your hand this whole way.
No. But that's what we'll be doing next week. So I hope you join us for that. And then, until then, Nerds out.
This has been a Non-Productive Media presentation. Executive producer, Frank Hablawi. This program and many others like it on the Non-Productive Network is distributed under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license. Please share it, but ask before trying to change it or sell it. For more information, visit non-productive.com. Thank you.